Welcome to this edition of Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host for this episode, Dr. Christine Smith from Salt Lake City, Utah. Today, I'm joined by Mr. James Bates, who is a substantive ENT consultant and rhinologist from the Buckinghamshire NHS Healthcare Trust and an honorary ENT consultant at Oxford University Hospital Trust. Mr. Bates is the first author on a recent IFR publication, a phase one research trial to evaluate the safety and effectiveness of intranasal botulinum toxin type A spray for patients with rhinitis. We'll be discussing this paper today. Welcome, James, and congratulations to you and your co-authors on the paper.
Thank you very much. Thank you for letting me join today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for coming and making the time. We're going to jump right into our discussion. Over the past several years, there has been a growing public and clinical interest with botulinum toxin, more commonly known as Botox, and not just for cosmetic uses, but for a variety of medical applications, including headaches, migraine management, hyperhidrosis, spastic muscle disorders, including overactive bladder, spasmodic dysphonia, and blepharospasm. Hatox, which you discuss in your paper, is a new form of botulinum toxin, which is primarily available in cosmetic clinics in the US, UK, and Australia. James, can you start off by giving us an overview of that, what Hatox is and what disorders or symptoms it's meant to treat?
Thanks. So Hatox is an amalgamation of hay fever and Botox. In our paper, we actually don't use Hatox very much because A, it's a trademark phrase, which was trademarked in Australia by a cosmetic physician. We rather prefer using like intranasal Botox spray because I think Hatox is quite presumptive to say that Botox treats hay fever. And what we can talk about is that actually there's no evidence at the moment, but it's being widespread use, Hatox.
That's so interesting. What is the mechanism of action or the thought process behind potentially using this intranasal Botox to treat rhinitis?
Modern theory of allergic and non-allergic rhinitis suggests there's hyper-innervation of the nasal mucosa. Botox nasal spray is thought to manipulate the autonomic tone of the nose, in particular the parasympathetic drive, by blocking acetylcholine neurotransmitter release. So as soon as you realize that, actually, that's just like the most amazing action. If it works, if it's absorbed through mucosa, which we don't know, is it? It'd be amazing. The theory that it adjusts autonomic tone, when we were looking at this problem, we thought it would probably reduce symptoms of running predominantly rather than nasal obstruction. But that's just sort of looking at the physiology.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the more challenging symptoms that we have to try to treat in our field. You mentioned that there's limited evidence supporting the effectiveness of this intranasal Botox despite its growing use. Why do you think people seem so enthusiastic about this?
I think it's all marketing. There's enthusiasm over it because it's being marketed by cosmetic clinics or cosmetic practitioners. And it's definitely a problem. If you Google Hatox or Botox nasal spray near me, you will see how much it costs and who's doing it. And very, very few ENT surgeons are doing it. And in terms of price, when I was in Australia, when we did the research, it was 500 Australian dollars, which is about just over 250 US dollars, similar in pounds. And there's no evidence. And that's a huge amount of money compared to a nasal steroid spray, which has evidence. Yeah,
absolutely. And so what drove you guys to look into this? What was kind of the reasoning behind deciding to do this study?
So I did this study whilst on fellowship in Brisbane, and we're in a massive department, and we had a very small minority of patients who came in and asked about hay fever, Botox, or Hatox. And then as a group, the three, myself and the two senior authors in this project, started to look at it. And it's fascinating, A, that there's no evidence, B, that it's being used and marketed widespread. Even more interesting that in Australia, there's a branch of the government called the Therapeutic Goods Administration, called the TGA. And basically, they've put an online warning that it's not approved for use or for marketing or for sale in Australia. And there's a corporate fine up to 15 million Australian dollars. Despite that, it is still being marketed and still being sold. And those bits just blew my mind. I was like, I can't believe that this is actually being marketed, being used. And we really wanted to try and debunk or investigate, does this work? Is it safe? Because at the moment, we had no idea. It was just out there.
I mean, that sounds like a great reason to do this trial. With those things in mind, can you outline what the overall aim of your trial was and what specific clinical questions you were hoping to ask?
So this is a phase one trial. So predominantly, it looks at safety. And we tested safety by using a symptom log. So patients self-reported symptoms. We also monitored them incredibly closely for the whole trial. And they also got repeat video flexible nasal endoscopy to check mucosal health. So that's point one was safety. Point two was to start to investigate, is it actually effective? And we can talk about what we tested. But effectively, we tested total nasal symptom score, peak nasal inspiratory flow, and a visual analog scale of symptoms. So those were the three tests to see if it was effective.
Excellent. That sounds like a great design. And then can you walk us through what the general methods of your study were?
So we recruited 15 patients. These patients all came from the tertiary or quaternary level rhinology clinic. So they'd all had maximum medical treatment, and all patients prior to, so they were recruited, they then had a month of standardized therapy. So they all had an intranasal corticosteroid spray, which was mometasone for a month. And they'd stopped antihistamine, nasal douching, they'd stopped everything else. And then they received the treatment dose of Botox nasal spray, botulinum toxin type A, which was 20 units to both sides. And then they were monitored for 12 weeks.
And what did your cohort ultimately look like?
We initially recruited 15 patients. As you can see from the paper, we actually excluded one patient because he was high risk for polypharmacy. So in the end, we had 14 patients who received treatment, 11 of which had allergic rhinitis, 3 had non-allergic rhinitis. We defined that through RAST allergy testing and serum total IgE.
Perfect. And then how was the Botox spray actually prepared and administered to the nose?
So we used something called a mucosal atomizing device, shortened to MAD. This is a device that the anesthetists use when they are preparing the nose prior to, say, fibroptic intubation through the nose. So it atomizes droplet particles into the nose as a spray. And we attached the MAD device to an insulin syringe, so a small syringe.
Gotcha. And then how did you guys actually arrive at this dose of 40 units and the atomization method? Why did you choose that as a part of your trial?
Yeah, that's good. The previous research of Botox for rhinitis has involved injection into the nose, so either into the inferior turbinate or septum. And the doses that these previous studies had used varied between 8 units and 200 units. 200 units is effectively the maximum dose of Botox, which seemed a bit sporting to give someone 200 units. And realistically, 6 units per kilogram is a reasonable dose. And we ended up falling on 40 units total, which seemed to us like a perfectly reasonable starting dose to test safety.
And then I know that you've mentioned that safety was your primary outcome and you looked at some symptom scores as well. Can you just remind our listeners what those outcomes were?
So total nasal symptom score is a scoring method where patients self-report symptoms of itching, congestion, rhinorrhea, and sneezing. And then that gives them a score out of 12. Mm-hmm. And then we use peak nasal inspiratory flow. We did that at baseline, so prior to having treatment, and then 4 weeks later. And we also use visual analog scale. So it was 10 centimeters long, and they marked on that scale where how bad their symptoms were. And they measured it at the start and at the end of the trial, so week 12.
Okay, well, let's chat about the results of your study, which I personally found very interesting. What did you find when you looked at the safety outcome? Did you guys see any adverse events?
There were no adverse events. It was entirely benign. No patient had any symptoms after the spray. No sneezing, no itching, no epistaxis, no problems.
That's great. I feel like that's better tolerated, at least in your study, than most of the other intranasal corticosteroids that we prescribe.
Yeah. And so when they received their spray, we monitored them for about 40 minutes. And they all basically, all the patients just sat there, you know, reading a book or looking at their iPhone, and they had no issues. So, you know, in terms of safety, initially, that's fine. And actually, when you look at the safety data in terms of video flexible nasal endoscopy, there was no change to the mucosa. And then over the period of 12 weeks of the study after they received the treatment, again, there were no significant reported adverse events. So, you know, that did show that it was safe. We kind of suspected it would be safe, but we had a very hard time getting the project through the regional ethics committee, which there's a lot of concern about the risk of downstream complications. So if the spray escaped the nose, and in the paper, the reviewers questioned how we avoided that. And yeah, so we avoided that through technique and the volume of spray that we used.
Yeah. I also found that very interesting and was wondering about that too. So it sounds like that low volume of spray and the atomizer device gave you guys that technique of delivering the Botox to the nose in a way that it didn't escape the nasal cavity in a clinically significant way.
No, it didn't escape the nose. I tested it on one of the research nurses, just saline. We tested a saline spray to work out what would be a reasonable volume. And the correct position. So the position was sort of sniffing the morning breeze, as it were.
Perfect. And then I found one of the parts of your paper really interesting to be the patient-reported symptoms. Can you tell us a little bit about those results and what you guys saw?
So patient-reported symptoms, so total nasal symptom score. If we were going back to theory of the physiology, we thought it would probably just reduce some of the rhinorrhea symptoms. In fact, across the board, all four components of total nasal symptom score, so itching, congestion, rhinorrhea, and sneezing were reduced, which is amazing.
And I had the same reaction.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting that they reduced across all four component parts of total nasal symptom score. And then if you look at total nasal symptom score, there's something called the MCID, which is minimal clinically important difference, which is defined as basically a 0.59 unit change. In our study, for all patients, our study showed a 0.85 unit change. So not only is it statistically, it's also clinically significant change.
I'll admit, I was a little bit surprised when I read your paper and saw those results, and particularly how like homogeneous they were in the patient population. Is this what you were expecting when you did the study? Were you or your team surprised?
We were surprised, definitely. But that's the nature of research. Like, it's a well-designed study. It was quite interesting to do. But there are some important points to talk about. So I presented this research in both Sydney and Budapest in the recent European Rhinology Society. Mm-hmm. And the punchline of my talks have basically been that at the moment, whilst it shows that there's a clinical and statistical improvement in symptoms, I can't exclude the impact of placebo. Yeah. And this is a phase one research trial. And I suspect there is a high degree of placebo effect. And when I presented it in ERS, there were loads of clinicians taking photos of all of my slides. And they came up and spoke to me afterwards and said, okay, how often can I repeat it? How much can I charge? And I tried to temper the enthusiasm of the people who are taking photos by saying that I'm not going to pay off my mortgage with this. I don't think we should use it in widespread clinical use. In fact, the whole point of this research was to see, is it safe? And to start to debunking this potentially quite dangerous practice, which we are in the process of trying to debunk.
Even when you look at the placebo effect, because that's one of the things that jumped out to me as well as a potential limitation of your study, it's usually not so pervasive or sustained over time. So
I know.
It's very interesting that at that 12-week time frame, you still saw those significant improvements in clinical outcomes. And especially when that's when we think that Botox is often starting to wear off in most people.
Yeah, totally. But if you realize that when these patients were recruited, they all knew that realistically they're getting this treatment for free. It would normally be $500. They'd also going to be effectively wrapped in cotton wool by a research team and have someone like me call them regularly and catch up with them. There was definitely a degree of placebo, which you can't exclude.
Yeah.
And I appreciate the results continue for 12 weeks. You know, and another limitation was that we didn't do peak nasal inspiratory flow at 12 weeks. We only did the peak nasal inspiratory flow at 0 and 4 weeks. And there was no change. But as we're all aware, peak nasal inspiratory flow isn't a great test. The symptom reported outcome measures are much, much more effective.
Yeah. And whenever we're talking about the nose, often the subjective symptom scores seem to be stronger drivers of treatments than our objective symptom scores. And so I found that interesting as well. You've mentioned a couple limitations of your study so far. Were there any others that you think it's important for people to know about when they're looking at this work?
Yeah, so obviously, in terms of recruitment, we're recruiting patients who've got refractory symptoms, who've had maximum medical treatment. And is this a fair representation of the average patient with rhinitis, be it allergic or non-allergic? I don't think that is. I don't think that the patients we recruited are also representative of patients who would go to a cosmetic clinic for this treatment either. That's a small point. I also think that we investigated non-allergic and allergic rhinitis patients. Why did we do that? Well, our thinking was that in cosmetic clinics, the cosmetic practitioners aren't going to do formal allergy testing, either skin prick testing or formal RAS testing, to define the difference between allergic and non-allergic rhinitis. So that's why we included both those cohorts of patients. And actually, if I had my time again, I probably would just test patients with allergic rhinitis.
Why?
Because I think that non-allergic rhinitis is far more complicated and nuanced. And there are only 3 patients out of our cohort. And that's a small number who potentially could have impacted on the greater number of 11. So if I was to do it again, I would think about just including patients with allergic rhinitis, especially if this being marketed as Haytox, hay fever Botox, and why are patients with non-allergic rhinitis getting it? Mm-hmm. Just a small point, but interesting.
Yeah, it's a reasonable limitation to consider, particularly given that the kind of initial driver behind your study was to look into that Haytox component of its current use. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know you mentioned a little bit earlier about how you wanted people to kind of slow their roll and temper their enthusiasm for the results of their study. And so tell me a little bit more about what you think the current practicing otolaryngologist who's listening to this should think about intranasal Botox. Is there any role for it clinically at this point?
I think it's interesting to know about it, especially if you're running a subspecialist clinic and someone comes in and asks you a question. So then say to the patient, well, actually, this is kind of what the evidence is. This is where we are at, which is great. And that's quite a nice bit about this research. But I honestly don't think you can start opening up and using it in clinical practice or start marketing it, for instance, because I think in medicine, most people follow evidence-based medicine, and we yet to have full evidence for this.
What do you think we would need to give us more information about whether or not we should really be trying this in our clinical practice? What do you think the next steps are for this research?
Well, as a minimum, we'd need a phase 2 research trial. So we need further robust testing, and you need robust testing against placebo.
Yes, I think that's important too. What do you think some of the big barriers to that phase 2 trial happening are?
Finance.
Yeah, Botox is very expensive.
Yeah, and you know, to recruit the volume of patients required and to have the research team is a big outlay. And of course, you know, the other barriers are, well, if you're going to test it against placebo, what placebo are you going to use? Well, we could discuss that. Or are you going to test different doses? Or are you going to test against other recognized treatments of allergic rhinitis? But then if you test against other treatments of allergic rhinitis, you potentially unblind your study.
Yeah.
For instance.
It's complicated.
You know, it's complicated. It's a complicated problem.
Yeah. And honestly, one that I think is pervasive even in the other treatments that we use inside of the nose, where we don't always have that super high quality evidence to support the use of the treatments that we're prescribing on a day-to-day basis. I think a lot of listeners and people who read your paper will look at this and wonder, you know, where is this going to go next, particularly with the popular rollout of intranasal Botox in those cosmetic clinics? Do you think that we're going to see it slow down as a result of your research, or do you think that your research is going to kind of keep driving this forward and have people increase its use?
I suspect, slightly tongue-in-cheek, what I'm about to say is that our paper might actually promote the use of Botox nasal spray. I say that slightly tongue-in-cheek because actually what we're trying to do is debunk and prove safety and efficacy, which we have done. We've achieved that, but I'm not going to use it in my clinical practice. And I did the research trial, and I couldn't sit here and tell you that I would be happy charging someone for Botox nasal spray at the moment.
Yeah.
Until we've done a phase two trial and it's robustly done, I think people just have to hold tight.
Yeah. I think that's really important. It's really important to hear from like you and your team that we need to take a moment and get some additional information, because I think it's very easy to read this paper and get excited about this as a treatment option. We all have lots of patients who have recalcitrant symptoms despite using everything that we have available, and having one more thing in your arsenal is really appealing. But I think you're right that getting better data, more robust data, that placebo-controlled trial is really important, particularly to support such an expensive treatment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, James, thank you so much for joining me today. This has been a really excellent discussion. I personally learned a lot and got more insight into your paper from having the chance to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time. Congratulations again to you and your team. Thank you, of course, to our Scope It Out listeners. This is Dr. Christine Smith for Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. We're signing off for now, and we'll see you next time.